I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. The scandal surrounding Virginia's governor, Democrat Ralph Northam, has brought the pernicious practice of blackface and the painful history of minstrelsy back into the cultural consciousness. White America's love affair with blackface began in the mid-19th century. It continues to endure nearly 200 years later on college campuses and in popular media. But for Northam and others who've been named and shamed, is saying sorry enough? Today on Midday, racism and redemption. As America faces yet another teachable moment, will we ever learn our lesson? Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and Baltimore Sun columnist E.R. Shipp and the author Lawrence Ross join me. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Everything is Wonderful at Baltimore's Everyman Theater. First, the news. Good afternoon and happy Valentine's Day. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today on Midday, a conversation about racism and redemption. When Virginia Governor Ralph Northam was first confronted with a page from his medical school yearbook in 1984, he apologized for being one of the two people in a photograph that showed a white man in blackface and a person dressed in the hood and sheet of the Ku Klux Klan. Calls for his resignation poured forth from both Democrats and Republicans in Virginia and around the country. The next day, he announced that neither of the people in the photograph were him, but that he had worn blackface and moonwalked. Contest, evidently, happened around the same time in his life some 30 years ago. You no doubt know that in the ensuing days, the rest of the story unfolded in surprising ways. It continues to unfold. The governor has said he will not resign. If he does step down, either voluntarily or not, the next in line of succession is the lieutenant governor, Justin Fairfax. Fairfax has been accused by two women of sexual assault and rape, which they allege occurred in 2004 and 2000, respectively. If he leaves office, as many have called for him to do, the Attorney General of Virginia, Mark Herring, is third in line to be governor. Last week, in the wake of the Northam revelations, Herring also reported that he, too, had appeared in blackface at a party in 1980. This is a story that transcends state politics in Virginia. The political implications of the actions and alleged actions of these men are a story for another day. Today, we simply ask, what is the deal with white people dressing in blackface? Is it ever okay for white or black people, for that matter, to don the look of minstrelsy, which for generations has been recognized as demeaning to and racist against people of color? Is it a practice that certainly, or rather, it is a practice that certainly did not begin or end in the 1980s, but how should the fact that these two officials wore blackface at that time inform how we think about what they did and what form their contrition should take? And what about others who have worn blackface? The list is long. It includes Desi Arnaz, Fred Astaire, Dan Aykroyd, Milton Berle, Joan Crawford, Bing Crosby, Billy Crystal, Ted Danson, Judy Garland, Bob Hope, Boris Karloff, Buster Keaton, Hedy Lamarr, Janet Leigh, Sophia Loren, Frank Sinatra, Grace Slick, Spencer Tracy, Shirley Temple, John Wayne, Mae West, Gene Wilder, Sarah Silverman, Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, and many, many more. My guests are E.R. Shipp and Lawrence Ross. E.R. Shipp won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary. She is a journalist in residence at Morgan State University in the School of Global Journalism and Communication. She joins us on the line from the studios of our friends at WEAA Radio. Shipp, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Lawrence Ross is the author of six books, the latest of which is Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. He joins us on the line from Los Angeles. Lawrence, welcome back to the show.
Great to join you again.
So, Shipp, let's start with you. Is it ever okay to be in blackface?
You mean, is it ever okay for white people to be in blackface?
Yeah.
It is not okay. I can't imagine an incident where it is okay. Blackface has a particular definition. It's not just putting on dark makeup. There's a lot more to it. So I think that, no, it's never okay to go in blackface.
And Lawrence Ross, what do you think?
Oh, no, it's not. And I think it's important for, even before we talk about kind of like the individual, you know, whether or not one individual person, is it okay for them to get into blackface, to basically recognize where blackface begins. It is literally one of America's first entertainment forms, which was centered around white supremacy, denigrating the idea of enslaved Africans being human, or even free Africans being equal to whites. And so obviously any manifestation of a person wearing blackface is a buttresses this notion that black people are not equal or not human. So of course there's automatically the idea that this is not something anyone should be doing.
Let's listen to a little clip from a press conference that the Virginia Governor Ralph Northam gave the day after the revelations of his medical school yearbook were made public.
I'll tell you exactly what I did, Alan. I dressed up in a Michael Jackson, excuse me. That's why I had Pam with me. I had the shoes. I had a glove. And I used just a little bit of shoe polish to put on my cheeks. And the reason I used a very little bit is because I don't know if anybody's ever tried that, but you cannot get shoe polish off. But it was a dance contest. I had always liked Michael Jackson. I actually won the contest because I had learned how to do the moonwalk.
And E.R. Shipp, you write in a piece that you published in The Sun a couple of days ago Ralph Northam, you actually used the example of Steve King, the congressman from Iowa, who doesn't seem to really even understand what it is he did wrong. It seems that Ralph Northam perhaps has the same dilemma. How would you explain it to him in terms of what he should realize he did?
I think what he exhibits is the same thing we're seeing with people who in more recent days we've questioned about their choices. The Gucci sweater that looks like it's blackface and the Katy Perry shoes, for example. It's evidence of this white privilege. They have the freedom to be ignorant of the history and culture of those around them who are not like them. And if they never understood white privilege, this is one way they can begin to understand that. You are mocking black people. You may not think that. You may think it's cute, but you have ignored history. There's no reason for that. There are many opportunities to learn about black people, black culture, other minority peoples and cultures also, by the way. There's no reason not to do that, except that you are so comfortable in your whiteness and in a feeling of innate superiority that you don't take the time to learn. And therefore, you make these stupid mistakes thinking you're just being entertaining and cute. I would try to explain that to the governor, but also to others who also seem to have a penchant for stumbling into this quagmire.
Yeah, and the list of people certainly in the entertainment field is long. I just read some of the names in the intro to this segment. And Lawrence Ross, you spent a lot of time on college campuses lecturing, and you've written a wonderful book about the pernicious racism that certainly still exists on many of America's college campuses, which we like to think of as these bastions of, you know, liberal equity and progressiveness. Blackface didn't start in the 1980s, certainly. It started 100 years prior to that. But it's still going on. This is not a problem that's relegated to the 1980s.
Right. And one of the things I always tell people is that when it makes it very convenient for folks to think, oh, that was in 1980s, 1984. That was so far away. It was a different time. Or then we see something in the 60s and, oh, different time. We had a blackface incident at the University of Oklahoma 3 weeks ago. So blackface is not an aberration. I literally studied college campuses, yearbooks from 1946 up until around 2016 when my book came out. And it was I joke, but blackface is almost as common on college campuses as cheerleaders on a college football field. It is not, literally not an aberration. And what's happening is that colleges and universities are acting shocked that they've had blackface, whether or not they're in their yearbooks or incidents amongst their predominantly white fraternities and sororities. Of course they have, because colleges and universities aren't these, you know, idyllic utopias, or as I talked about one time before in your program, not these educational Disneylands where they're not affected by the same white supremacy, same racism that goes on in regular society. But we like to think that. And so these students come into these universities, college and universities, coming from segregated neighborhoods, coming from segregated school systems. And of course, when they get on campus, particularly when they have the comfort of being in mostly all white environments, yes, they'll manifest the racism. Actually, they'll manifest the racism as part of the cancer of the white supremacy that runs through the course of the United States. So we shouldn't be surprised. We shouldn't be surprised by Northam. We shouldn't be surprised by the kid 4 weeks ago who was caught doing blackface. It's part of who and what we are.
I'm glad you said that, because I think we sometimes assume too much about how progressive young people are on college campuses. My introduction to college many years ago was at the University of Georgia, and many of the white students were still resisting our presence there. In various forms, I think what we're still seeing is our white students resisting the notion of inclusion and diversity. Many of them see it as a threat to what they'd always presumed to be their privilege in life. So some of this acting out at fraternity parties or at homecoming events is probably an expression of that.
And, of course, and Lawrence Ross, you've written about this, that it's not confined just to the South. You mentioned Oklahoma, but, you know, there's plenty of students. I mean, there were blackface incidents at Yale University just, you know, a year or two ago.
It's important, not to cut you off, but it's important to understand that, because when we discuss race in this country, oftentimes when white Americans and white people and white college students in particular, they think there's a cognitive dissonance between what they think who think a racist is and who they are. They think that if they're morally good, then they can't possibly be racist. So they can always say, well, it was a joke, or I didn't mean it, and I'm not a racist. And so what they tend to do is make the assumption that whiteness is naturally good, and the racist is a subset of whiteness. Pick redneck, hillbilly, pick a southern state. Those people in Mississippi or Alabama, those are really the racists. But when you look at blackface, or you look at any of the racist incidents that occur on college campuses, they occur in blue state Oregon, in California, in Vermont. They occur all through the country, because we have that same foundation. Just the same as we have freedom and democracy, we have white supremacy as one of our foundations. Now, we fight against it because we believe in our principles and ideals, but again, it courses through all our veins. It just may be that it might be a little bit more prevalent in communities that are more, like I was say, prone to saying that they don't have a problem with racism, at least overt racism. You might see more instances that way. But in terms of geographic, no, there's nothing that puts it directly into the South only, and not in the Midwest or West or East or North, the Northeast.
In 2000, Jimmy Fallon, who's now the host of The Tonight Show on NBC, was a cast member of Saturday Night Live. Here he is doing an imitation of the comedian Chris Rock, and he was dressed in blackface at this time.
Man, oh man, read this book. I've seen Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and guess what? Not a lot of black folks on the show.
Right.
Not a lot of black folks on the show. You know why? Because black folks don't like to answer questions. Or they want to be millionaires, but you got to ask that kind of question, like, in 1981, how many grams of crack did Rick James smoke when he recorded Super Freak? Regis, you think the only way to get a brother on the show is to name it Who Wants $50 Cash and a Pair of Pumas?
Well, Ship, there's a whole lot to, you know, look into there. Why do you think it is that 18 years ago that performance didn't create even a ripple of offense or reaction or criticism? What's happened between then and now?
There are a number of things. At first, I don't remember the skit, so I don't remember what he looked like. Did he do the exaggerated features, or did he put on dark makeup to look like Chris Rock, whom he was imitating? Some of that has to be unpacked, I suppose.
I think it's dark makeup, I would describe it as.
So yeah. I'm not sure we would call that blackface.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you are an actor or actress, you do things to look like the character you're playing. So sometimes we have to sort some of these things out. But to to your point of why there was no reaction, again, I don't know the skit, so I can't visualize what he looked like. It could have been that there was a complaint, but no one was listening. If mainstream media outlets don't pay attention, then oftentimes mainstream America doesn't think there's a problem. It could have been that people were complaining below the radar screen, as it were. But I think you still have to separate the performer putting on makeup to play a character versus what we're really talking about.
Fallon's costume was by no means the exaggerated features, the big lips, and all of that kind of stuff. That he looked strikingly like Chris Rock, and of course he had the voice imitation down quite well as well. We'll come back in just a second. We'll take a break and then have more with E.R. Shipp. She's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. She's on the faculty of the School of Global Journalism at Morgan State University, and Lawrence Ross, who lectures frequently at schools across the country. His latest book is called Blackballed: The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. If you'd like to join our conversation when we come back, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet @midday WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, Midday on the Arts. We'll have a conversation with the administrative executives and players of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. Management and the musicians are involved in a protracted contract negotiation, and they are deadlocked in a dispute about whether or not the orchestra should reduce its schedule from a full year to 40 weeks. We'll hear from both sides tomorrow here on Midday. Plus, I'm going to speak with two local actors, Seamus Miller and Gregory Burgess. They're starring in the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company's production of Henry IV, which opens tomorrow night. That's all coming up tomorrow at noon here on Midday. And later today, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick joins me. She's going to have a review of the new show at the Everyman Theater. But first, back to our conversation about racism and redemption with E.R. Shipp of the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University, and the author and lecturer Lawrence Ross, whose latest book explores racism on college campuses. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet @midday WYPR, and to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. Lawrence Ross, let me ask you about another thing that's been brought to my attention, which is really kind of an interesting thing. I don't think by any means it is a pervasive issue, but there is a group of African Americans called the Zulu Crew, and it's one of the social clubs in New Orleans that participates in Mardi Gras every year. And it is, I think, 98% or 99% African American. There are a few white people who've been invited to join the crew. The head of the organization is called the King of the Zulus. They dress in blackface, and it's the exaggerated kind of blackface we're talking about. These are not the kind of actor black makeup that Jimmy Fallon was wearing. We talked about the distinction there. But they do dress in an exaggerated blackface for their Mardi Gras float that they, you know, parade through every year. Is it... is there a distinction to be made when African Americans do it as opposed to when white people do it? The crew, as I understand it, did encounter some pretty serious resistance in the 1960s from people who were involved in the civil rights movement at that time, but that criticism sort of died down, and now they do it every year. They get dressed up like this every year. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I think there's always a difference in terms of who is actually able to take or redefine something that may have been negative. For example, you know, Burt Williams was one of the most famous actors of the, you know, the late 19th century, early 20th century, and he had to wear blackface in order to appear on stage. And he actually appeared to be, you know, one of the best actors in the country. But yes, he actually had to put on the kind of the cloak of what other actors were doing at the time. Now, the Zulu Crew in New Orleans is part of a crew that at the time, this was not an unusual thing in terms of crews wearing blackface. It was kind of almost a standard operating procedure during Mardi Gras for the different crews. Now, what the Zulu crew basically did, along with the coconuts and all the everything that they do, is that they tried to redefine it as being an African American version. Now, you can make a distinction about whether or not in 2019 whether or not they should still be doing it. It's the exact same type of conversation we have about the N word. And I'm not going to say it on NPR, but N word in terms of whether or not there's an ownership that redefines it with, you know, that's intracultural within the African American community that has a completely different meaning when it's used by the person or a group of people who use it as a power construct to denigrate black people. So there can be, even in a nuanced sort of way, there can be two different definitions depending on which person or which group is actually using something and whether or not the people who were originally denigrated can actually redefine something into a different way. Now, again, there can be an argument about whether or not they're doing it, but it's not the exact same thing as when white people use it from a position of power to actually say that black people are not human.
And it should be the advice to people who are not black who are trying to do this is don't. Always know what the rules are of the particular group you think you're honoring in your mimicry. But your fallback position should be don't.
Yeah, it strikes me as it's the same thing as the N-word. It's just simply not usable by white people.
And I also I think to even, you know, make it a little bit more apparent, there are 105, 108 historically black college and universities. And at no point in time during any of my research did I note that any of the students, and this is from 1946 on, that any of the students wore any type of white face, quote unquote, to disparage white people around St. Patrick's Day or Columbus Day or anything in terms of being able to say, oh, you know something, we're mocking these people. Because blackface in particular has a specific reason for existing. And its reason for existing is to strip the humanity from black people. Black people are not trying to do that in terms of a different types of system. So they're not trying to strip the humanity of white people by putting white face on, for example.
We have an email from Terry, which I think echoes some of the comments both of you made in the first part of the show. Terry emails, I am white. As a child, I was in a minstrel show in blackface. The goal of a minstrel show is to make fun of ignorant black people. I lived in Kansas. I never saw any black people, and being in that show taught me that black people are ignorant and stupid. Not until I was in college and I met a wide universe of people during the civil rights movement did I understand how hurtful and thoughtless such behavior is. And Chip, you write in your column about the need for things like Black History Month and education around issues just like this.
For sure. I'm not the greatest fan of Black History Month because it gives too many people the false illusion, I suppose, or the illusion that just learning something during those 28 days in February is enough. I think
it gets them off the hook.
Gets them off the hook. You need to be exposed 365, 24/7. But because so many people are so ignorant, even in 2019, something like Black History Month is necessary to at least focus some attention, provide outlets. Hopefully provide opportunities for discussion so that people can learn. That just assumes, though, that people want to know more. I think some people are just willfully ignorant, and we will never change their minds. But for those who are curious, February, Black History Month, can be a good way to engage in a better understanding of who black people are, what we've contributed, and the fact that you can't tell the American story at all without including all that we have contributed since 1619.
There was a terrific...
I always look at Black History Month as being just one of the partial steps. You know, we began with Negro History Week and then went to Black History Month. But to me, we oftentimes during Black History Month, we look at individual achievements to show the inclusion of blackness within the American construct. I'm more interested in deconstructing the white supremacy and teaching that history in order for new generations of Americans to understand what they're fighting against and what they have to deconstruct. In the same way, we should talk about the history of misogyny in this country and deconstruct that on a gender basis. Because the moment we start doing that, then we can start getting to the point to where by the time a white student gets to college, they will already understand that blackface is not some whatever rationalization they want to make it. They can understand that it's a direct connection to white supremacy, the thing that they've been learning about since preschool.
And then they can make a choice of whether they want to perpetuate that or whether they want somehow embrace this diversity of culture.
Yeah, there was a terrific exhibition at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture here in Baltimore that included several examples of minstrelsy and how it was used in advertising, how it was used in books, how it was used in movies. It was really beautifully done. I don't believe it's there anymore, but it's a the kind of example that so many people talk about as being really crucial to be part and parcel of whatever history of African-American history is taught. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We're talking with Lawrence Ross. He's the author of 6 books. His latest is called Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. E.R. Shipp is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. She's a columnist for the Baltimore Sun and journalist in residence at Morgan State University here in Baltimore. Our email is midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR, and our telephone number 410-662-8780. Let's go to the phones to John in Baltimore. John, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how y'all doing?
Great.
So I'm just curious about the two guests' thoughts on the Spike Lee movie Bamboozled from 2000. So I think that would have even taken place before the clip you played earlier. That was one of my favorite movies, and I have a hard time like talking about it now because I don't know if it still holds up quite as well. Like back then when it came out, it spoke to a lot of the things my friends and I back in New York were thinking about and talking about as far as movies and TV went. But
give us a quick thumbnail of the movie. It's not a movie that I know. If I saw it, I don't remember it.
Which Wayans brothers is it? Damon Wayans plays the sole black member of a board of executives for a TV channel. And after pitch after pitch after pitch of shows that he thought would be great ways to elevate the African-American image on TV back then, this is like, again, 2000, they all get rejected. So he just leans in and pitches a new minstrel show that has black actors and black musicians, including The Roots. The Roots were like the house band for the movie, all in blackface and doing like old school minstrel show up in it.
All right. Well, let's get our reactions from Shipp. Have you seen this movie? Do you know what we're talking about here?
I don't know the movie, but I think it was supposed to be a satire, but I don't really know that film. Mm-hmm.
Lawrence Ross, how about you? Do you know it?
Yeah. It's supposed to be a satire, and it's basically a satire on the power and the lack of power that black people have in terms of the representation of blackness, meaning that, and it kind of echoes in terms of the types of shows that you see that are greenlit on television, which perpetuates the idea that black people are not fully human. And that's what Bamboozle was really trying to show. And to show that this show that should be immediately rejected due to the fact of how racist it is actually accepted and embraced all the way up the line, which shows in terms of how Hollywood deals with imagery, which goes back to what you were talking about in terms of the long list of white actors who were in blackface. How Hollywood does not have the best intentions of black people when they actually put out black images on television or in movies.
So it was a critique of what's going on,
as opposed
to embracing blackface as a way
to
go.
Yeah, very different perspective. Yeah. So E.R. Shipp, what about the case of Mark Herring? He's the Attorney General of Virginia. Once the revelations about Dr. Northam's medical school yearbook came out, he went out and announced that in 1980 he too had dressed in blackface at a party, I guess, in college. Is there a distinction between a white person who does that and sort of preemptively says, I did this and I apologize, and a person like Mr. Northam who, allowed or who waited until he'd essentially been outed?
Well, I don't really see much of a difference in this case because it's not as if the attorney general on his own talked about this past behavior, how he had changed and how he was a different man committed to, you know, embracing a broader society. He was kind of forced out of the closet because of what was going on there. So I don't really treat him differently than Northam. I think Northam could have used this earlier, perhaps, to make a statement about his behavior. He was outed, as it were. So it's not as if he would have ever perhaps talked about this part of his past, what he had learned, and what he can teach other white people. He was forced into this position to save his political career. So I don't give either man a pass at this point.
We have an email from a listener named Pete who says, I think it's interesting that the subject of blackface performance has come up at a time when there's also been a vocal condemnation of cultural appropriation. Although their tone was mocking and exaggerated, earliest minstrel show performers also presented themselves as recreators of black culture. Beyond the act of simple theft, this has seemed to me to be one of the sins of cultural appropriation. Although they didn't put blackface makeup on, performers from the U.S. like Tommy Dorsey through Elvis and Eminem do damage of the minstrel show and reinforcing, or do the same damage of the minstrel show and reinforcing racist stereotypes. Lawrence Ross, I mean, has the minstrelsy tradition, you know, permeated culture to the point where you know, that kind of damage, anytime you allude to black culture, if you're not an African-American person, you're ginning it up a little bit?
Well, I don't know if it's just alluding to black culture. I think, you know, culture is not something that has, you know, walls and boundaries to where you're sitting up and saying that, you know, this is our culture and it cannot influence someone else. I think the biggest thing is always whether or not you acknowledge where you get your influences from. It's one thing that if you are influenced, say, for example, you're the Rolling Stones or you're the Beatles, and one of the things that you recognize is that you're making covers of blues musicians, but you don't say that you're making covers of blues musicians. The Rolling Stones and Beatles, for example, did. They would always talk about the fact that they were influenced by these people, oftentimes forgotten by most Americans. And they would say, you know, these are influences. This is how we're creating our own sound. Yeah, but there's a difference between that and then saying, I'm going to go into something that's predominantly black or predominantly Latino or predominantly LGBTQ. A lot of times things that go into our culture are then taken from communities that don't have the power to control their own narrative and then are appropriated, and then the person who is given credit, who never should have been given credit for that appropriation.
You know, that's why I was a little upset with some of the criticism that Jennifer Lopez received at the Emmy Awards performance she did in tribute to Motown. And a number of people said that a black person should have done that tribute. I wouldn't go that far. I think she was honoring Motown. And there was nothing demeaning in what she was doing. It was all about honoring Motown, and it was quite clear what she was doing. That was the segment. So I think sometimes we take these things too far. Even the person who wrote the email that you read seems to have been giving credit to the minstrel shows for recreating black culture. They were not.
Yeah, not that they were mocking it completely.
They were mocking it all. So we should be very clear on what it is we are condemning and what it is that we're saying it's okay to do when you're performing. We're not just saying white people can never sing black music and white people can never imitate black people when they're performing, but we're saying there are particular things we're talking about. Blackface is a particular kind of mockery, and that is what we're talking about.
Wallace Lowe, the president of the University of Maryland at College Park, you know, issued a statement when it came to light that there were many examples of blackface in various yearbooks from the University of Maryland from the 60s, the 70s. There's a fraternity page in a 1970 yearbook from University of Maryland that shows members imitating a lynching, and another fraternity has a page that includes references to their annual minstrel shows, along with photos of these men in blackface. Now, I graduated from college in 1977. I went to college in New York, so and this was not something that I ever encountered in my own experience. But, you know, those people, if you're in college in the 1970s and you're doing that, at this point, if you're still alive, you have had a long career, one would suppose. You would, you have been in the working world. So Lawrence Ross, I mean, this is those kinds of experiences have to shape and inform how people live their lives. Is there a point? Is there a way for a person who was involved in that kind of behavior 30 or 40 years ago to, in fact, evolve, change, have a change of heart that is credible and sustainable?
Well, you know, first thing is Dr. Lowe was actually at one of my lectures at the University of Maryland for a campus racism lecture, so he should not be surprised that the University of Maryland, of all people, should not be surprised that the University of Maryland has those representations inside the yearbooks. But to your question, you know, I always tell people I'm not in a redemption business, meaning that one of the things is that, yes, of course, human beings can evolve. They can redeem themselves. They can do great works. They can do all that. But I'm less interested in that than the societal issue of how do you deconstruct the very thing that made it okay for them to depict and denigrate me and denigrate the people who I love and my culture in the first place. And if they haven't done that, if they haven't done anything to deconstruct that, then I'm not really sure whether or not I, to be honest, care about whether or not they're redeemed, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, 30 years later. And it's important because what's happening is that the grandchildren and the children of those people, not maybe directly, but of those people are still doing the same behavior.
Dr. Melanie Price, who's a political scientist, wrote a piece in the New York Times yesterday, and I thought she made a really good point, Ship. She says there's a huge double standard. African Americans are constantly expected to distance themselves from anybody that white people view as problematic. She put as an example President Obama's association with the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. But here we have a person, Mr. Northam, whose problem is actually doing racist acts. It's not even association with racists, and yet we think that, you know, he can somehow be redeemed by saying, I'm sorry.
I think he can't be redeemed by saying, I'm sorry. He has to go beyond that. But I wanted to pick up on something before we let it slide too much. People are expressing surprise that in a yearbook we see this blackface and imitation of lynchings and such. We probably want to try to limit our condemnation to the fraternity that did this or to the individual who did this. But I want us to think about the fact that it's the yearbook for the whole university. A whole lot of people were involved in the process of approving that. So we sometimes want to say that it was
just like the medical school yearbook in Virginia in 1984. Yeah.
A lot of people are involved in that. So a lot of people are implicated in perpetuating this kind of racism. So let's just not blame the one or two students whose faces we see. There were editors, there were academic advisors, there was a lot of people were involved.
Yeah.
So we need to all, more people need to take responsibility for this kind of behavior, and more people need to take responsibility to learn what it is they're doing wrong so that they can undo what they've been taught.
E.R. Shipp is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. She's a columnist for the Baltimore Sun and journalist in residence at Morgan State University. Lawrence Ross, the author of 6 books, including his latest, Blackballed, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. That's all the time we have for this discussion, and I very much appreciate both of you joining. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Speaking of redemption, coming up next, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews a new play at the Everyman Theater whose theme is forgiveness. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.